1980s, Beirut was in the middle of a bloody civil war, and Westerners became vulnerable targets for hostage taking, with Islamic groups using them as bargaining chips. In a moment, Terry Waite, Brian Keenan and John McCarthy talk about their experiences, along with Jill Morell, who worked so hard for John's release. They all join Sue McGregor for the reunion after this.
On Great Lives this week, Matthew Paris and his guest, the broadcaster Colin Murray, beam the spotlight onto Frank Sinatra.
The 20th century in a voice. He was modern, he was complex, he had swing, he had attitude.
Did I get a kick out of you?
Great Lives on BBC Radio 4.
Pack up, let's fly away.
Tuesday afternoons at 4:30.
And don't tell your mama.
Now, for the first time since their release in the early 1990s, the Beirut hostages come together to talk about their time in captivity as they join Sue McGregor for the last in the current series of The Reunion.
In Islamic groups, at least 10 hostages died in captivity. Some were murdered, some died through lack of medical attention. Of the English-speaking survivors, few captured the sympathetic imagination of the British more than John McCarthy, Brian Keenan and Terry Waite. Terry Waite, who worked for the Archbishop of Canterbury, was incarcerated for almost 5 years, four of them in solitary confinement. John McCarthy, a television journalist, spent over 5 years as a hostage, and his cellmate Brian Keenan, Irish and a teacher, over four. Between them, they clocked up over 5,000 days of captivity. The campaign to free them was fought on many fronts, putting a spotlight on their families, and in the case of John McCarthy, on his girlfriend Jill Morell. The long wait for freedom was to change all their lives radically. The centre of the kidnapping and the incarcerations was the divided city of Beirut. The extremist organisations who knew the city well found plenty of reasons to justify a kidnapping campaign.
11 American diplomats have been evacuated from Beirut and airlifted to Cyprus. It came only hours after the kidnap of an American journalist, Terry Anderson.
When a group of teachers at the American University of Beirut were taken hostage in late 1985, Western governments advised their nationals to leave the country. Their safety couldn't be guaranteed.
At 7 o'clock this evening, Eastern Time,
Then, on the 15th of April, 1986, things became really critical.
American aircraft from British bases and...
American forces bombarded Libya, using British bases to refuel.
It's a scene of considerable destruction. There are houses crushed and collapsed. The French embassy was badly damaged. The house next to it, which had about four families in it, is completely destroyed.
Within days, Arab reprisals had started.
In Lebanon, the bodies of three men have been found in a mountain village. Diplomats in Beirut believe they're those of three Britons kidnapped by Muslim extremists. At Beirut airport, another Briton was seized. He's John McCarthy, a television journalist.
I appeal to you, whoever you are...
Friends and relatives of the hostages back home made direct appeals to their captors. This is John McCarthy's mother, Sheila.
To release my son, John McCarthy, and return him to his mother and father... who miss him a very great deal.
Also missing, Belfast-born Brian Keenan, who travels on an Irish passport and vanished in Beirut a week ago.
Brian Keenan had left Belfast to teach English at the American University of Beirut 4 months earlier.
All we know is that he left his apartment.
His sisters, Brenda and Elaine, were understandably nervous.
Just before he left, I said to myself, you know, Brian, are you doing the right thing? It's like going from the frying pan to the fire. And he said, well... Yeah, there's a war here, there's a war in that country.
With me sitting round the table are the former hostages, John Terry Waite. And also with her is Jill Morell, who campaigned for John's release for 5 years. Brian Keenan, let me start with you. Why did you want to go to Beirut in the first place? It sounds a pretty hellish place.
Yes, it was unemployment. I was unemployed at the time, and like many people, what do you spend years and years at university and be a teacher for? To sit and watch TV all afternoon. And I, oddly enough and strangely enough, when we heard that clip about Libya, it was a choice between going to Libya to teach or going to Beirut. Somebody told me that the women were better looking in Beirut than they were in Libya. And that seemed reasonable enough.
John, you were there as a television journalist, and ironically, you were picked up as you were on your way out.
That's right. Yes, I'd gone there just for a month to manage our office for the TV agency I worked for. I was very excited, really, and I think, looking back in a very naive way, to get an experience of working in the field. But then Brian was picked up, obviously, and we heard about the bodies found of Lee Douglas and Philip Padfield, two other Brits who were taken and murdered. So it seemed like a good idea to get out.
And you were stopped by masked men?
No, we were literally driving along a quiet road. A car screeched past us, slammed on the brakes and sort of blocked the road in front. And a very tall guy, I remember him now, jumped out, big guy with a big beard and a big machine gun, and came and just stood at the front of the car and started shouting, came round to my door, opened it and grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and took me off and threw me in the back, and away we went.
Was it much the same for you, Brian? You were on your way to work, and ironically you'd just been talking with your colleagues about being safer on that journey.
Yeah, because I lived only a 7 minutes walk from the university that I was teaching in. And I can remember distinctly leaving. I lived in an old Turkish villa, gorgeous old building, and I came out through the garden, which was full of butterflies that morning, and closed the gate behind me. There was an old Mercedes parked across the street. And as I closed the gate and lifted my bag and walked off, the Mercedes drove across from the other side of the street, and the doors opened so that I couldn't get past. It was a narrow street. And I stopped, assuming people just wanted to get out. Well, they did, but they wanted me to get in as well. So they jumped out with their guns and threw me into the back seat and took off.
Terry Wade, you were kidnapped at the beginning of the following year. Was it a difficult decision to go there, or did you have sufficient cause to believe that you were going to be able to do good?
Well, originally, I did not want to go into Beirut at all. I'd just finished in Libya, and had been successful in having a part in the release of British hostages who were held there. I was approached by the Americans, and I was able to establish contact with the kidnappers. I met them secretly in Beirut. They told me that what they wanted was better conditions for their blood relatives who were being held in Kuwait on a variety of terrorist charges.
Going back to April 86, Jill, you were working in the same outfit as John was in London. Can you remember how you heard that he'd been kidnapped?
I'll never forget that day, yes. I was at home and John was due to arrive back later that day, so I was just getting up thinking about what time I'd go to the airport, what I was going to wear. And then the phone rang and it was my boss at work, Roby Burke, and he said, "Jill, bad news, John's been kidnapped."
He was about to come back. You were buying a house together. You were going to get married, you thought.
Suddenly,
with one phone call, all changed.
Yeah, everything changed with that phone call. I didn't realise it at the time. At the time, you're just coping with the shock of the news. And Roby wanted me to bring a photograph of John into work so that it could go on the lunchtime news. So I focused on that task and threw all these photographs out of a box, trying to find a decent one of John, and getting upset that I couldn't find a decent one, and then rushing into work with the photograph, and then waiting for news.
John, as a journalist, just give us the political context of these kidnappings. It was a pretty febrile time in that part of the Middle East.
Well, it was certainly the fact that Prime Minister Thatcher had allowed the Americans' bombers to fly from Britain to carry out those bombing raids on Libya was an indication that the pro-Libyan groups might have a reason for picking up British, or in Ireland's case, associated British Irish. But there was no clear indication as to why that was happening, which was confusing.
But the thing that's more important, I think, is that the people that held us were very, very organised. This wasn't just a random lifting off the street and then we'll work out something later. This was well planned and very well organised.
Now is a reasonable time to come back.
On the 13th of January 1987, Terry Waite was back in Beirut in his attempt to negotiate with the hostage takers.
The last time Mr. Waite was here, he left with American hostage Jacobson. But that was a few days before the row over American arms for Iran broke.
What do you think Terry Waite's chances are of getting more information about Brian?
For Brian Keenan's sisters, Terry Waite's visit supplied great hope.
Once Terry's out there, there's a chance of something.
Within hours of arriving and being bundled away by his bodyguards, he says he was in direct touch with some of the kidnappers, though he's now widened his mission.
Waite's movements were becoming an obsession with the British press, as were his supposed secret meetings with Oliver North, who'd refined President Reagan's arms for hostages deal with Iran into what became the Iran-Contra scandal.
Captors discussed amongst themselves whether or not they should take me hostage.
He explained at that press conference that the hostage takers he was meeting were nervous.
They weren't certain as to whether or not I was who I claimed to be.
The Archbishop of Canterbury's special envoy, Terry Waite, hasn't been seen publicly in Beirut for more than 24 hours. He left his hotel last night, and nothing has been heard from him since.
I remember covering the story, and all journalists thought, why did he go there? It was against the advice of the Archbishop of Canterbury. At least that was the way the news were portraying it at the time.
A hostage by the name of David Jacobson was released, and I went to see him in Wiesbaden. Where he came for a debriefing. And I couldn't understand what I'd done to obtain his release. And then, at that point, the news came through about Iran-Contra. It was broken to the world. And that was the point that faced me with the dilemma. Should I now pull out, or should I continue on behalf of the other hostages? And I felt that I could not, in all conscience sake, pull away at that stage.
And a week after you arrived in Beirut, you too were captured.
I met with the captors. I thought my chances were very, very slim. But I felt, I've come so far, I'm going to go through with it. I went back and was taken. I was put into a van in the middle of the night, driven across town, got out of the car, was told to jump down. There was a trap door in the floor. And when a door closed behind me and I took my blindfold off, I was in a tiled cell. Then I knew the game was up. I was known as a trapdoor in the floor. And when a door closed...
And, Brian, you were kept...
...tiled cell.
...it. You had a compared with Terry, a reasonably short period of solitary confinement. John, remind us how you met Brian for the first time.
Well, it was after, I guess, 3 or 4 months of solitary confinement. And we were kept in this underground prison. I was absolutely terrified, and I think went through a process of sort of reviewing my life and feeling it hadn't been up to much, getting desperately, desperately frightened, but managed somehow to hang on and keep going, and then was transferred. And I remember sort of taking the blindfold off, thinking, where am I, whatever, and as I did so, saw another pair of shoes and a pair of jeans and eventually another face appearing,
but a
bearded
face.
Madly bearded face with hair all over the place, and just looking and saying, me, it's Ben Gunn, because he looked like literally the wild man from Treasure Island, and that was it. And we then spent days talking intensely to each other, but not understanding a word, because I couldn't get Brian's Belfast accent, and he couldn't understand me, because I sounded too much like Prince Charles. Yeah.
Well, he does have this awfully charming English accent, and I don't, obviously, but I remember that thing distinctly, and when he said, it's Ben Gunn, I looked at him, and looked at him, and looked at him, and said, who the f*** is Ben Gunn? And those first kind of months together, it was kind of, oh God, like, I'm not too sure about him.
Because we found that not a superficial level, it's not that, but we can make each other laugh, and that was, you know, very crucial, I think, as we carried on. Having been through the experience of solitary confinement, well, I think we both recognised that we'd really gone to the edge of ourselves and to try and find who we were and how we could cope.
Were you hallucinating often? I mean, studies of people in solitary confinement often indicate that you can see quite clearly visions of things that aren't there at all.
Not seeing visions, but hearing things, because there's very strange sound. Actually, Brian will talk about this, but very strange, because we were deep underground, so you've got this piping system, and you began to imagine that you could hear not only sounds from the outside world, whether that would be people moving around, or indeed sometimes music.
Yeah, I heard music. I don't have a musical bone in my body, but in that period of isolation, I thought I heard music, and it was like a rhapsody. Here I was, entranced, carried away, swept away by this kind of orchestra coming out of the ether, and it was gorgeous, and it was intoxicating, and then it got very, very, very frightening, because it wouldn't go away.
Terry, you were in solitary confinement for an almost unimaginably long time, 4 years. I don't know, you've written and talked about this before, but I still can't quite understand how you did it, how you got through it.
Well, the first year was one of extreme stress because I was frequently interrogated as to what I knew about Iran-Contra. That interrogation period ended when I faced what mercifully turned out to be a mock execution. My way of dealing with it was to try and take an interior journey, to make an exploration, to try and get to know myself better, both the light and the dark side.
Could you put a face or a name to any of your captors?
Oh, yeah, I remember them. There was two guards, Saeed and I can't remember, Bilal or something, who I think John christened the Brothers Kalashnikov. And believe it or not, we even had a code name for our friend Mr. Wade here when we were talking about him, so the guards wouldn't understand. We referred to Tiggy Winkle. And that psychopath Saeed we used to call Top Banana.
Jill, you were pretty much an unknown in this at the time of John's kidnapping. You decided that you would start a campaign.
I went to Paris to see Joelle, to meet her and also to meet the hostages that were being released.
Joelle Kaufman's husband had been kidnapped.
I'd been kidnapped for 2 years at that point. When I got to Paris and saw the huge campaign there, the comparison between what was happening there and what was happening at home in Britain was so amazing. It was, everyone in France knew about the hostages and they wanted the government to do something to bring them home. It was a political issue.
I remember in 1988, we were either with or just had been with Terry Anderson and Tom Sutherland, the two Americans the longest held. We had a radio at that point, and we heard a report talking about the hostages and saying that the friends of John McCarthy, he believed, were beginning to affect Foreign Office thinking. And Brian and I sat there thinking, wow, what are they doing? And that's all we heard then, because the radio disappeared for another 2 or 3 years, so we didn't hear any more.
Brian, you had an Irish passport. That was a political act on your part, but maybe the British government, or maybe not, would have done more to find out where you were if you'd had you'd kept your British passport.
Well, let me tell you about that. I'm Irish, so I have an Irish passport. However, the British government complicated that terribly for me. Because when I was first taken, then I thought, I'm going to get out of here. And then I said to them, look, I'm Irish. What do you want me for? And then Margaret Thatcher, in all her wisdom, made a statement saying that another British citizen, i.e. me, had been taken captive in Beirut. Well, thanks, Margaret, because I now was a spy.
I do remember asking one of the guards, you know, inevitably one tried, so he said, what do you want now? It was 2 years in, 3 years in, what's the deal? What is Islamic Jihad or whatever you call yourselves? What do you want? And then they were saying, you know, Britain is a bad country, it's a, you know, imperial power, etc. So I said, well, what, you know, Brian's Irish, they've done nobody any harm. And there's a long pause, and he said, Brian was a mistake. we shouldn't let him, because, yeah, you're right, Ireland's fine. And I said, well, why don't you let him go? And they said, what about you, John? He's your friend, he keeps you happy. You know? So I was very grateful for that.
You did get out early, didn't you?
Yeah, I got out 4.5 years late. but it's when they brought the pyjamas. I absolutely knew it when they brought in pyjamas.
You thought, I'm in for the long haul here.
And I refused to wear them.
A news conference this morning in Tehran, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mr. Rafsanjani, appeared to suggest that Mr. Waite and the journalist John McCarthy are both alive.
He spoke in terms.
Despite encouraging signs from Tehran, the British government stood firm on its policy of no deals with the hostage takers.
It is not an easy policy to follow. Sometimes it's agonizing, but it is right.
But then in January 1989, a religious edict from the Iranian leadership fanned the flames of discontent throughout the Middle East.
The Ayatollah Khomeini this morning sanctioned the death of the author Salman Rushdie and all those who helped him publish the book The Satanic Verses.
The families of the hostages implored the publishers of The Satanic Verses not to publish a paperback version. Terry Waite's cousin, the broadcaster John Waite, advised Salman Rushdie to proceed with caution.
I would ask him to think about the lives of innocent hostages, not just Terry Waite, but all the other hostages, and is it worth it to publish a paperback for this notion of freedom of speech when freedom of individuals, and indeed his own liberty, is at stake?
Tonight I'll sing my songs again, I'll play the game.
with diplomatic relations between Britain and Iran apparently severed, Jill Morell changed tack and turned to the advertising agency Bartle Bogle Hegarty and the singer Paul Young for an emotional cinema campaign.
My criticism has always been that they've just taken the hostage issue lying down. They haven't fought it at all. But I hope that they're now aware that there is enough concern in the country as a whole that the hostages should be released. Music's playing home, where my love lies
waiting silently for me. You looked quite moved by that.
Yeah, it just brought... At that time, it was a really bad time. It was after the Rushdie affair had ended all our hopes, because in the summer of 88, we could see things happening, delegations to Iran, and Iran accepted the UN's conditions for ending the Iran-Iraq war. And then we had the satanic verses, and the whole thing just stopped. Everything was just like a door slamming in all our faces, and that was it. Everything was over. And then the advertising agency got involved with our campaign, and they just took it to another level with these fantastic cinema adverts. And so it does bring back strong memories of us feeling sort of, on the one hand, how long is this going to go on, but thinking that things are moving again.
We heard that there were improving, thawing relations between Britain and Iran, which we assume must be a very good thing for us.
We didn't talk out loud about it when we were talking about, well, what kind of Iran they are. So we had to invent a code word for our discussions. And just as we refer to Terry Waite as Tiggy Winkle, we refer to Rafsanjani as Rough Stuff Jimmy.
That's right.
Your cousin, John Waite, broadcaster, yeah, was mounting his own campaign to keep your name in the news. Were you aware of that? You weren't, I suppose.
I wasn't aware of it until right near the end, when I got the small radio. And then I do remember hearing John. And on my birthday, they had a little item when they played some of Bach's organ music. And I got a message from the family for the first time. It came across. I can't tell you how remarkable that moment
was. That was after how many years?
That was about 4.5 years. It's odd, isn't it, John and Brian and Joe? It's odd looking back, isn't it, on these days?
I still find it baffling. I mean, Sue asked you the question. It's all very well reading books and listening to you talk, but I still don't understand how you managed to keep your head together for 4 years on your own. It's still remarkable to me, particularly as you never had those sort of occasional moments of hearing about the outside world, just to give you a flip, just to think, well, it's still there. But you had nothing.
Well, you know, when I was first captured, three things came to mind, and I don't know where they came from. I said, for goodness sake, don't regret what you've done, because you'd be demoralized. Don't feel sorry for yourself, no self-pity. And don't be over-sentimental. Now, that sounds a bit pie, I know, but I needed something to hold on to, just to say, this is the way you're going to behave, and you're going to stick it through.
They took us somewhere down far south in Lebanon.
Because they did move you about.
Oh, yeah. And it was in an old barn in the hills, a tiny place, but it was just rough stone walls, and there was no heating whatsoever, and it was friggin' freezing outside. So we had the cold. So we asked for tissues. So they would give us, you know, half a dozen or maybe half a box of tissues. When they run out, you didn't get any more. So they would occasionally bring in a little one-bar electric fire to heat the room up, and you had to dry your tissues.
I always used to ask for books. One day, a kindly guard said, OK, I'll try and get you a book. He didn't know what to get because he couldn't read English, you know. One day he came into the cell and he dropped it by my side. Of course, I was blindfolded. When he went out, I picked it up. Laughed out loud. Unknown to himself, he brought me Great Escapes. It went from bad to worse. He then brought me a manual of breastfeeding.
Oh, we had that too.
So you had the manual of breastfeeding.
Yeah. Did you read it? I didn't bother.
Well, I had to try and find a way of getting the person at the other end of the line who was getting the books off the shelf. So what I did, I asked for a pencil and paper, and looking beneath the blindfold, I drew the picture of a penguin. And I said, if you see that on the front of a book, buy it. It'll be a good book. And, you know, 2 weeks later, I got As I Walked Out by Laurie Lee, first Penguin book. And I got Penguin books after that.
Good evening. Brian Keenan. who was a prisoner for 4 years and 4 months, is on his way to Damascus. As the Irish Foreign Minister arrived to meet Keenan's two sisters, the news broke.
We have an awful lot of people to thank. We couldn't go down the list, but I mean, everybody knows who we need to thank, and we thank them.
On the 24th of August 1990, Brian Keenan was released.
I feel a little bit like a cross between Humpty Dumpty and Rip Van Winkle. At this moment, my thoughts are obviously with my family, and particularly my mother, back home in Belfast. I'm delighted, of course, to have my two pin-up girls with me. And if I could just say to Mum, get the pan on.
Back in Dublin, Brian Keenan spoke about his fellow hostage, John.
John boy, I called him. How can I forget Johnny McCarthy, whose humour, whose mimicry, whose abundant love of life, on so many times seemed to diminish to almost extinction those grinding moments of hopelessness. Hostage is the humiliating stripping away of every sense and fibre of body and mind and spirit. But he is a man, a rare, unique, and beautiful creation of which these things are no part.
Brian, you'd thought about this for a long time.
Well, actually, I didn't think about that speech for a long time. I remember reading it the night before in the hospital. When I got home to Dublin, they for reasons that I didn't know, they wanted to do some checks, tests on me. And I was happy enough to go into hospital until I woke up one night and the walls were the same colour as the last room I'd been held in. And the room was about the size of one of the cells. So I said, pray God, I'm getting out of here. And when the doctor came in the morning, I said, I'm going, I want out of here.
I was, you know, so relieved that Brian had gone for his own sake, obviously. But also because I knew that within, you know, a day or two, however long it took him to be released and get home, he'd be able to talk to Jill and my parents. I didn't at that point realise my mother was dead.
And you'd had no news of your mother's death?
No, I learnt about that because I think the same day that he was released, Terry Anderson and Tom Sutherland, the Americans, arrived in the cell, so we had a kind of our own reunion then. And so Terry Anderson, yeah, because I said, oh, by the way, have you heard anything about my family? And there was a long pause, and I was asking Tom Sutherland, and he just stared at me sort of vacantly, and there was a long silence. I began thinking, everybody must be dead, you know. And then Anderson stretched right out across from his corner on the end of his chain and sort of just held my hand and said, we heard, I don't know, a year ago that your mum had died.
I'd known John's mother and father, and they'd been to see me in Lambeth, you know, prior to your captivity. But then also, this is a Brian's release was an important time for my family. I mean, I didn't learn this until later, but he was able, because of my tapping on the wall, to tell Francis that I was alive.
And this eventually led release of you, Brian, and led to another tectonic shift in that you, John, and you, Terry, met for the first time, in rather difficult circumstances.
Well, yeah, we were together. Well, just to set the scene, we were in the same apartment block where Brian had been, and Terry still in his room in solitary confinement, me with the two Americans. And I was bundled down, all taped up and gagged and blindfolded, even in a sack, I think, and dumped in the boot of a car. Normally on those journeys, I'd always obviously been with Brian in the past, but this was sort of solitary. And then getting used to having a bit more room, I thought, in the boot of Mercedes or Volvo, whatever it was, the boot lid opens again and suddenly this huge thing is dropped on top of me, more or less.
Six foot six.
There's a long pause, and then the voice says, "This is a very large boot," to which I reply, "It was until you got it." And this is weird. And then there's this kind of terrible scrabbling of us getting our tapes out, and we managed to find, I don't know how we got out of the sacks as well, and shook hands.
This is the first time, you see, I'd met anybody else apart from my guards. After this is about 4.5 years, roughly that. I mean, I started to talk, and quite a lot, because I got this tape off my mouth. First time I'd had a chance to talk to anybody at all. And you will say, for goodness sake, you know, be quiet, be quiet. They'll hear us in the front. And then I started to tap on your hands as I tapped on the wall in code. Yeah. And we exchanged some words like that as we were travelling.
And were you then in a cell together?
No, but they'd broken the ice, so to speak, literally by throwing himself on top of me. And when we got to the other end of the journey, the Americans and I were put in a cell together, and we just kept saying to the guys, look, we know it's Terry Waite. He's been on his own for a hell of a long time. Just bring him in here. And eventually, the chef, the leadership, decided that they could, so he was brought in so he could be with us.
Jill, you, after all these years, had somebody to talk to, Brian Keenan, about John, about what it was like to be a hostage. But a slightly tricky relationship, I would think, because, I mean, by now, he knew John better than you did.
He did. I mean, it was fantastic because we just drank it all in for hours and hours and hours, first of all.
But were you a tiny bit resentful of him?
I don't know if it was resentful. It was just jealousy, I think, of all the time that Brian had spent with John and all the time I'd missed. I'd missed all that time, four years at that point. And Brian had been with John for all that time. And I think just that, really, just jealous of that time. From Brian coming home then, we sort of learned what it was going to be like for John and how difficult things were going to be post-release.
And there would be a different John for you.
The lovely thing was that John sounded just the same.
There was, Jill, a very poignant moment, actually, just before John was released, on Christmas Day, and we had the radio, and you were speaking on Outlook.
Jill was speaking.
And it was preceded by Lessons and Carols from Kings. The first time we heard Outlook, because Outlook was repeated several times a day, the first time we heard it, we couldn't really quite catch what you said. And we thought, we'll wait up because Outlook's coming on again, and we know it's coming on and we'll be able to listen to it. And blow me, when it came on again the second time, they cut it in favour of Lessons and Carols. And
the Archbishop's Special Envoy was saying, for God's sake, get a move on with these carols.
Come on, move them on. We've heard enough carols. We want to hear what Jill's got to say. That's right. And we were there. I remember in this wretched place somewhere in the Bacar Valley with this little radio on a cold Christmas day trying to catch what you said. I'd forgotten that until this moment.
And then on the 8th of August 1991... came the good news that everyone had been waiting for.
Good evening. The headlines at 6 o'clock. John McCarthy, the British journalist held hostage in Beirut, is free.
Well, hello. It's very nice to be here after 5 years. I would like just now to make a brief statement.
Watching the pictures from Damascus was Jill Morrell.
He looks great. He looks like the John that we saw 5 1/4 years ago, the John that we knew. It's absolutely wonderful to see him. He's got, you know, the sparkle in his eye and... His voice, to hear his voice alone is just wonderful.
The bells of the journalist's church in Fleet Street ringing for the freedom of John McCarthy.
Both the doors are open. We're not quite sure which one he'll come down. There's a whole fleet of cars were waiting beside the aircraft which will carry him away to meet Douglas. And there he is. John McCarthy is home.
And finally, in November 1991...
It's been confirmed by the United Nations that Terry Waite has been released after nearly 5 years as a hostage in Lebanon. An American, Thomas Sutherland, was freed with him.
When we were sitting together in our cell, one of our captors came in and told us that Tom and myself would be freed this evening. He also said, we apologize for having captured you. We recognize that now this was a wrong thing to do, that holding hostages achieves no useful, constructive purpose.
John and Terry, you were released 3.5 months apart, I think, in 1991. John, when you arrived at RAF Lynham, you probably knew there'd be a lot of your colleagues there in the press. How did you deal with that? Was it a bit overwhelming?
It was overwhelming, and actually listening to the sound of it again, or having seen it on, you know, repeated, it's almost as if I'm watching me as a stranger coming off that plane. It seems such an extraordinary event. And I just remember
coming out and thinking, right, I've got to get down the steps, and being totally blinded by all the flashlights from the cameras and camera crews, and being quite nervous at the same time, so elated to be home, but feeling quite out of control.
And Terry, when you were released 3.5 months, I said, after John, what struck you about the world?
Looking back on it, that was a very confusing and difficult period. I too, like John, went to Lyna with my family, and almost immediately had to take a blast from the media, who were then coming out with the fact that the main reason for my captivity was that I'd been involved in arms dealing with North. And that was exceptionally difficult to take, because, you know, I'd convinced my captors that I was innocent of that particular charge. At that point then, after that, when I saw the way the media was going, I just withdrew completely, cut myself off, and just spent the next time with the family away from everything.
And Brian, once you sort of come to and got out of hospital and began to settle into a vague kind of normality, what was it that struck you about the frying pan that you'd gone back into? Was it quieter than that?
No, cars had a fifth gear. Yes. That really threw me. Cars had a fifth gear. People were drinking beer out of bottles. You go into a bar and you order a bottle of beer, and I still can't get my head around that. And the other thing that I find really difficult for about 6 months was sitting on a chair. You know, I go visiting people and I would sit on the floor in their living room and look at my... And I wasn't conscious that I was doing it, but people would say, why are you sitting on the floor?
And what about relationships with your sisters, with family, with friends, new relationships? Were they easy to pick up?
No, I didn't try to. I went to see my two sisters. My mother was still alive at the time, and explained to them that I wanted to get away, because I wanted to think about who I was, what I had to say, and what I was going to do with whatever this new reality was. Because you have to remember, you spend 4.5, 5 years, or whatever length of time you were there, in a very heightened reality, and you suddenly are sprung into another reality, and you have to make a massive kind of readjustment shift. And that's particularly difficult in intimate relations.
John, did you have a strategy?
No, I don't think I did. I'm very conscious of what Brian was saying there about the sort of heightened sense of reality that we've been living in constantly, if you like, for years, effectively on an adrenaline rush, and a focus on each other within the cells, what we were saying, thinking about things incredibly deeply. For, you know, conversations would run for weeks and months, and always listening beyond. And I think coming back, initially feeling entirely comforted that my father, my brother, Jill, and other close friends were there and just seemed to be entirely the same. That was enormously reassuring. But then I was wary, and perhaps sometimes frightened, of the amount of interest in us, that although I'd been aware of the success of Jill's campaign and that we were effectively very famous, and that was clearly obvious, it was still a real shock to suddenly, wherever one walked, everybody knew who you were.
Jill, when you first saw John, he had said at a press conference, "Well, hello." Can you remember what he said to you?
I think it was. I think I said, "You're back." And he said, "Yeah, I am." I can't remember the detail of it, but it was just, as John said, really reassuring to see him. But as he said, it was a huge period of readjustment for both of us. I'd come from an intense period of activity, living on adrenaline the same way, but with intense activity. And for John, it was intense inactivity, but really heightened emotions and intense relationships. So we were sort of both dealing with an adjustment from that experience.
And huge media attention.
And huge media attention. And I think what we both wanted more than anything was for things to get back to normal, what we remembered as normal. But that wasn't possible. And it was very difficult dealing with the fallout.
I suppose there was also the pressure. The media wanted a happy romantic ending to all this. You were very conscious of that.
I think people wanted to know what was happening to us, and definitely wanted things to work out well for both of us. Yeah, and, you know, we did too. We wanted things to work out well for both of us too.
That outside pressure was a sort of a major distraction, because you're always sort of preoccupied with that, which is, you know, most obviously relationships, whether they're going through a good patch or a rough patch, don't have other people looking in on it in that same way. So that was a strange and not an easy point, certainly for the first year or so, I suppose. After
and we had new things to deal with as well, yeah. In terms of my mother got very ill soon after John came home, and then John's father got ill. So we always seemed to be having to deal with new things that were very difficult, and it was a quite a difficult time.
Yeah.
I think this is the first time since these extraordinary events that the four of you have sat down together.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, since after the first year or so at home.
Talk. Most of the time has been events, hasn't it? Yeah, this is the first time, really. And I've heard today, you know, some things from everybody that I had never heard before. Just didn't know.
It takes you back. It does take you back.
I think part of the problem, going back to your last point, is that it's not well understood by people. When you spend a long time going through waves of clinical depression and coming out of it and dealing with this heightened reality, well, at times when your whole psychological personality breaks down and you don't know who you are, and that's why intimate relationships become very difficult in that kind of atmosphere, which is what it was.
The readjustment certainly for me is still happening, and experiences like this are really helpful actually in making a narrative out of it that you can sort of understand and process a bit more. Really helps.
John?
I think so. I mean, it was interesting when we were gathering before we came into the studio, you know, we all gave each other a hug, and in a way that those years evaporated.
You and Terry are about a foot apart in height.
That's putting it kindly,
sir. That was quite a bear hug.
Yeah, that's quite a bear hug. But I think that is something that, although we may not have seen each other much over the past couple of years, that sense of understanding and caring for each other will never diminish.
I think it's one of the cardinal rules of, you know, the most exclusive club in the world, of which we're all members, and Jill, of course, is an honorary member of this club, is that God's a comedian. And if you don't have a sense of humour, you're dead. And I think we all have that in our different ways, and drew upon that because it's kind of life-giving and it's life-preserving. And
I just reminded about when I was about to go and they gave me clothes which never fitted.
too
big. Yeah, Lebanese. I said, you know, when I was captured, you took my watch. So of course they couldn't find it. So the chap went out and he bought me one. And I still have it to this day.
But nobody could find you a pair of size 14 shoes?
Unfortunately not. And I came out and I looked like a scarecrow, but I've tried to improve things since then.
Terry Waite, John McCarthy, Brian Keenan and Jill Morell. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
That edition of The Reunion was produced by Ruth Hedges, and it was the last in the current series. The series producer was David Prest, and it was a Whistledown production for BBC Radio 4. The programme will be back later in the year. Meanwhile, next Sunday sees The